Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences, and also our C-SPAN audience today. It's my pleasure to introduce David Davenport. He's the author of Rugged Individualism, Dead or Alive. He's also a research fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University, and previously was the president of Pepperdine University, one of our great other educational institutions, just not in the Bay Area. David, thank you very much for coming to share this with us.
Thank you, George. And ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be with you today. It occurred to me as we collected up yet one more spring rain, and we're competing with the Warriors playoff game, and I assume the Giants and the Dodgers game, I don't need to give a talk on rugged individualism. You are the rugged individuals for showing up here tonight, so thank you for coming. You're also brave to come and hear an academic talk. Of many good stories, I think, about scholars and academics, one I heard recently was at a scholarly panel that I was attending, and the moderator of the panel was a federal judge. And he said, you know, we have some of us, referring to himself, who are, as Teddy Roosevelt, himself a rugged individual, once said, we're in the arena. Our face is covered with dust and blood and sweat. And then he said, you have kind of out of the way, up in their ivory towers, the academics who are carefully watching the battlefield. And then when the battle is over, they come down onto the battlefield and shoot the wounded. And then he proceeded to say, we have three expert marksmen here today on our panel. So I will have to shoot a couple of people, probably not in the audience, but in history, as we think about rugged individualism and where it's been and where it's going. So my co-author and I, Gordon Lloyd, I'm not able to get us going. Let's see if I can do it over here. There we go. My co-author, Gordon Lloyd, and I like to, as we say, go back to come back. That is, we like to go back into history, but not just for the purpose of staying in history, but to see what we can learn and bring that back to policy today. And so in this book, Rugged Individualism, we wanted to go back into American history and see what we could recapture that might be useful for public policy today. And we especially spend some time in the New Deal. And in fact, one of the great speeches of Franklin Roosevelt that set up the New Deal was delivered here at the Commonwealth Club 85 years ago this year. So in a sense, I'll be responding, albeit a little bit late, to what Roosevelt said here at the Commonwealth Club that day. So rugged individualism has had an interesting history. My mother, who just passed away this year at age 99, when I would ask her about her sports teams, she would say, oh, they're up and down, they're up and down. And I thought, well, that's kind of true of rugged individualism. It has had its ups and downs. As Henry Kissinger famously said, even a paranoid has some real enemies. And rugged individualism has had some enemies over the years, particularly during the Progressive era. There was quite an economic critique of rugged individualism, and that continues through today. And I would say there's also been a sociological critique of rugged individualism, that it is a form of selfishness, of people kind of withdrawing from the society. And we'll look at both of those. And so it's had its ups and downs. There are people who would say that it is alive. There are people who would say it is dead. And so we offer you at the beginning of our book this matrix where you can decide for yourself where you would place rugged individualism. Would you say it's dead or alive? And then wherever you place it, would you say that's a good thing or a bad thing? And so President Obama, on more than one occasion, referred to rugged individualism as part of America's psyche, but he felt that that was largely a bad thing, he would go on to say. And then I would say that Dr. Lloyd and I believe that rugged individualism is alive, if only barely sometimes. And it's good that it's alive, and it would be better if it were even more robust. So there have been different people in history and even today who are in different places on this chart. The other thing I would say by way of overview is that we in the book sort of address this in two different ways. We try to look at the political realm and what that has done for and against the idea of rugged individualism. And then we also look at the intellectual realm of ideas. What are some of the ideas that are about in our society, and how have they affected rugged individualism? So let me try that again. No, let me try that again and take off my giant's watch to keep track of time here and go back just a moment in history. So individualism was very much planted, I would say, in America's DNA at the founding. It was G.K. Chesterton who said that America is the only nation that was founded on a creed. And part of the creed, I would say, of America's founding was individualism. And I'd say if there's nothing else you remember about individualism, to me, this describes it right here. The founders of this country no longer wanted the important decisions about their lives to be made by churches or kings or queens or the social class into which you were born, but they wanted to be able to make the key decisions about their own lives as individuals. And so that really, I think, was the founding idea, if you will, of rugged individualism, is we want a country where we are free to make the key decisions about our lives. And so, of course, the Declaration of Independence, as we know very well, talks about individual rights, how King George had abused people's individual rights, and how that really, that was the purpose of founding this country, was so that people could pursue life, liberty, pursue happiness. These were the individual rights that they wanted protected in this country. And the Constitution, sort of its companion document, if you will, is very much drafted toward protecting individualism. And I speak in part, of course, of the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, which is kind of a list of individual rights that the drafters of the Constitution thought needed to be protected mostly from the danger of their own government. But there are also parts in the main body of the Constitution that are very much about protecting individual rights. There are checks and balances. There are balances of power. There are separations of power, all to keep the government from, or majority factions from getting together and taking away people's individual rights. So very much stated in the Declaration, guaranteed by the Constitution, and now really entering its golden era, if you will, the golden era of rugged individualism on the American frontier. And the American frontier, when you think about it, is not just a place, was not just a location, a geographic place, but it was a whole spirit. It was a whole ethos of the time. And so Alexis de Tocqueville, the famous French journalist who came to this country in the 1800s and wrote about democracy in America, he said the very availability of land, the vast expanse that allows people to go find more elbow room, to relocate when they want to, is part of what makes democracy in America work. It's part of what allows individualism to flourish. And so he felt that this expanse, this wilderness that we had in America was part of democracy itself. An academic at the University of Wisconsin, Frederick Jackson Turner, wrote quite a bit about the American frontier. And in particular, in 1893, he wrote the Frontier Thesis. And he said, you know, America is not just different from England by reason of geography, but again, it's a whole wilderness ethos that has kind of grown up in America. And people gathering together, fishing and hunting and building their own houses and so forth, it fosters a sense of rugged individualism, although he did not use the phrase, as I'll share in just a moment. I make a note here that the frontier did include, however, collaboration. Sometimes people say, well, you know, they weren't really rugged individuals because they had wagon trains and they built huts together and they worked together and they collaborated. And that's absolutely the case. But I think the key is rugged individualism means that you have the freedom to consent to join these various groups. They were not regulated to join wagon trains. They were not mandated to build each other huts. But these are things that people out of their own freedom consented to do, wanted to do, saw the value in doing. So I wouldn't make the mistake of thinking rugged individuals never collaborate, never cooperate. And we'll talk about that more when we come to America today. So this was really sort of a heyday, the wilderness years, the Daniel Boones, wanting more elbow room. These are the heydays we often think of about rugged individualism. But then, as I mentioned earlier, rugged individualism came under attack from those progressives. In 1890, if you want to put a date on it, the American Census Bureau, the U.S. Census Bureau, said it would no longer count migration to the West, that we had reached the Pacific Ocean, and that was the end of the migration west, so we're no longer going to keep track of that. The frontier was, in effect, closed now in 1890, according to the Census Bureau. And so the argument of the progressives was, well, this is going to create a big change in our country. It's now going to be necessary for us to band together and to live in cities. And we're going to have more government. We're going to have more regulation if we're going to live together in this way. And in fact, we'll need to look to Europe more as an example, because Europe has been living with these kind of limits and boundaries much longer than we have. And then the attacks became more focused. Charles Beard wrote an essay called The Myth of Rugged American Individualism. I've sometimes said that President Obama must have been channeling his inner Charles Beard when he gave his famous "You didn't build that" talk. Do you remember that? You may think you built a business, but you didn't really build that. You didn't build the internet and the roads and the infrastructure that was needed. Now, my reaction was, well, I did pay the taxes that built those. You know, that should count for something. But his central point was government really built a lot of what you needed. Well, that was the argument that Charles Beard made. He said, you know, business people talk about rugged individualism, but he said, in fact, they want a lot of government help. And Beard makes quite a list of 15 or 20 things that business people wanted: bridges and canals and railroads and so forth, in order to make their businesses work. And so he calls it the myth of rugged individualism. Another famous progressive, John Dewey, more of an education philosopher, I would say, than anything else, called it ragged individualism. And he said, thank goodness, you know, we've now reached the end of the frontier, the end of the West, the move to the West, because we can finally get rid of this ragged individualism, which has really been sort of a curse on our society. Now, in that same time frame, rugged individualism had some defenders. And ironically, the person who coined the term was Herbert Hoover. I think, in a way, if you read that essay I mentioned about the frontier thesis by Frederick Jackson Turner, he should have named it. He described it in great detail. He just didn't stick the landing and get that actual colorful phrase. And so it was left to Herbert Hoover in 1928 in a campaign speech to call the American system, as he said, a system of rugged individualism. And this was important to Hoover because, if you remember your history, Hoover had spent most of his career up to that point as a mining engineer in various countries around the world. And especially during and after World War I, he led major food relief efforts in Europe, especially in Belgium. Herbert Hoover is still a national hero, not a hero in this country particularly, but he is a national hero in Belgium because he saved them really from starvation. And so when Hoover came back from Europe, he said, boy, I'm really glad to be back in America, because over in Europe, they're taking on all of these various forms of totalitarianism. They're becoming socialists, they're becoming fascists, they're becoming communists, all these sort of collectivist totalitarian ideas. And he said, I'm glad to be back in America where we have the American system of rugged individualism. And then he would always add, he would say, now, this is not a laissez-faire, devil-take-the-hindmost kind of individualism, because what we also have in this country, Hoover would say, is equality of opportunity. People have an opportunity to enjoy their individualism. And so Herbert Hoover is the one who coined the expression rugged individualism. And as I said, for him, it was always accompanied by equality of opportunity. Well, Then the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, which he kind of previewed here at the Commonwealth Club, became, I would say, a near-death experience for rugged individualism. Because Roosevelt clearly felt that part of the problem, and indeed part of the economic problem, he thought, that was causing the Great Depression, was rugged individualism. We're business people. He called them the titans, the economic titans on Wall Street and in New York, who would run the businesses out of their own selfishness, but would not be mindful of other people who needed to be taken care of in the economic system. And so Herbert Hoover would say, when Roosevelt and Hoover ran for president in 1932, Herbert Hoover rightly said, I think, this is not a contest between two men. This is a contest between two philosophies of government. Because Roosevelt wants to move away from individualism, what Hoover called the American system, and he wants a different system. His New Deal is a very different kind of system. And the American system versus the New Deal, as I said, the New Deal was about expert administrators, more central government planning, emergency measures, government growth. All of this was part of the New Deal that Roosevelt would bring along. And the way Gordon and I characterize it, actually caricature it, if we were better artists in our book, is the forgotten man and the rugged individual. Those are two sort of cartoon characters that sort of capture this debate between Roosevelt and Hoover. So you have what we think of as the rugged individual on the left, Herbert Hoover's American system, and we have Roosevelt's forgotten man here on the right. And Roosevelt basically would say, we need to replace the rugged individual with the forgotten man as the focus of government policy. And in fact, his Secretary of Interior, Harold Ickes, said, we have turned our backs for all time on rugged individualism. So Ickes said, you know, it's dead. We're turning our backs on it. We're now focusing on the forgotten man as the focus for policy. And so really, Gordon and I argue, in fact, this is our second book together. In the first book we did, called The New Deal and Modern American Conservatism, we argue that the New Deal really is the paradigm for American domestic and economic policy today, 80 years later. We live under the New Deal. It was expanded by President Johnson in the Great Society. It was expanded again by President Obama with health care. But it's basically the New Deal system that Franklin Roosevelt put in place. Interestingly, although in the 1920s you had a series of presidents who tried to roll back the government growth caused by World War I, we might have expected the same thing to happen after World War II in the New Deal, but it did not. Eisenhower did not roll back the New Deal measures, and other presidents began to build and grow on it. And, of course, the growth of the administrative state is sort of now a given. That's what we live with today. So we talk in the book, in Moving to Modern Times, about two modern political revolutions, the Great Society Revolution and the Reagan Revolution. And interestingly, I'll just tell this one anecdote about the Great Society. Interestingly, LBJ's Great Society, where, you know, he, if possible, it was said he wanted to out-Roosevelt Roosevelt. Roosevelt was his mentor. And he was such an effusive character. One time he stopped at a campaign stop. Actually, he wasn't supposed to stop and speak. He was just in a motorcade. But he couldn't contain himself. And he reached down and took up a bullhorn. And he said, in this campaign, we're for a lot of things and we're against mighty few. That's kind of a summary of LBJ and the Great Society. He wanted to, you know, he wanted to attack poverty. He wanted to attack it, to improve education. He wanted to improve the cities. He wanted to improve the rural areas. He really wanted government very actively improving our great society in every possible way. But when he made the changes that he did to health care for seniors, Medicare, Medicaid, he nevertheless left room at the table, if you will, for rugged individualism. And so under LBJ's health care, he added a safety net, if you will, Medicare and Medicaid for seniors who would need it. But for others, he said, you know, if you want to keep your own health insurance, if your employer provides health insurance, if you want to take care of your own, you can still do that. But we will create a health care safety net for those who are not rugged and able to do that for themselves. And actually, we hold that up in our book as a bit of a model. Wouldn't there be room at the table for both the forgotten man and the rugged individual? Wouldn't we want to leave room at the policy table in America for both of these important icons of our history? And as I said, even LBJ in his effusiveness and grandiosity did that. Then the Reagan Revolution really did a lot for rugged individualism rhetorically, but it didn't really turn out to trim back government as much, I think, as Reagan might have liked. But he did, I think, rhetorically sort of redefine the role of government in our lives. You know, he famously said that government is not the solution to our problems. Government is our problem. And he did carry out some very significant tax reforms. He did move policy and money from the federal government to state governments in many ways. But as I said, it was really in some ways more of a rhetorical victory than a policy victory. And then we also have philosophical debates, particularly in the realm of economics. And I'm going to skip forward to this debate today. The economists are still debating rugged individualism versus the forgotten man today. And today's version of it, if you will, I skipped over Milton Friedman and Michael Harrington and some others back in the 60s and 70s. But the debate today is really led by Thomas Piketty and his Capital in the 21st Century, Income Inequality, which President Obama called the defining challenge of our time. And one of the things that we think happens in our society today is, as Thomas Sowell, another Hoover fellow, said in his book, Intellectuals and Society, what happens today is that intellectuals come upon a problem that they write about or talk about, and then policy people sort of grab a hold of that and try to find and implement policy solutions. Al Gore and climate change would be sort of the classic example, where Al Gore developed, the scientists had already developed the ideas. Al Gore sort of packaged them up into a PowerPoint, went on the road, began talking about it. Then it became both domestic and international policy. And I'd say that's what's happening today on the economic side. Thomas Piketty, in his Capital in the 21st Century, Income Inequality, is becoming kind of the latest version of, should we do away with rugged individualism and move toward much more of a collective set of ideas? And so Piketty argues, it's a pretty bold book. If you've not read it, it's maybe a little thicker than you'd want to tackle. But, I mean, Piketty says safety nets aren't the solution. More education is not the solution for the forgotten man. We have to have income redistribution, he argues. And he said, really, the only fair distributor of money is the federal government. And he argues that the federal government should be spending more like 50% of our gross domestic product rather than the 25 to 30% it now spends. So it's a pretty radical set of social ideas, saying that really, in fairness, to take care of the forgotten man, education's not enough, safety nets are not enough, we need to redistribute money, and the federal government needs more control of that. The second critique of rugged individualism today, I sort of previewed for you, it comes from the realm of sociology, and I would say these two books sort of capture it. Habits of the Heart by Robert Bella and several of his colleagues, and Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. And they basically argue that what we had always feared, that what Tocqueville said when he wrote in the 1800s, is that individualism could become selfishness in America. People could just withdraw from civic life and just be content and happy in their own careers and in their own lives. And they both argue that that's really what's happening. That people are bowling alone, if you will, that bowling leagues and other forms of civic participation are sort of going away, and that needs to be redressed. My own view would be that, and we point this out in our book, that really there's plenty of evidence to the contrary. There's plenty of evidence that America is still the most philanthropic and generous country in the world. It is still the country that generates more churches, nonprofits, social organizations than any country in the world. So I'm not sure it's right to say perhaps some of the old forms of civic engagement have gone away. I don't belong to a bowling league, admittedly, But I belong to some other things, and I participate in some other things. So it may be that the forms of civic engagement have changed rather than gone away. Francis Fukuyama, who's now at Stanford as well, says, I think makes an interesting observation. He said, Americans might be anti-statist, but they aren't really selfish. And so it may be that Americans don't really like the government telling them what to do with their time and their money. But they're not really selfish. They're pretty generous with their time and their money. So this is a bit of a philosophical debate from the sociology side. And then, of course, we have lots of policy debates today. One that still goes on about Obamacare. And the tough thing about Obamacare is the elimination of individual choice. And it was really based entirely on the forgotten man. There was no room left for the rugged individual. I remember when both of my sons, neither of whom is terribly political, they each called me up and they said, Dad, our health insurance was just declared illegal. And I said, well, that's interesting, boys. Why is it illegal? It doesn't have pregnancy care, but we're not planning to get pregnant. I said, well, this is kind of the lack of choice that you have. And so here is a case of individualism sort of losing out, if you will, in the policy realm. So we close our book with some hope for the future. I guess it's probably good to have some hope. I lived in LA for 25 years, and I remember a bumper sticker on the 405 freeway in large letters, there is no hope. And then below that in smaller letters, but I could be wrong. So maybe that's the message I have for you here. It seems a little hopeless, but maybe I'm wrong, and maybe there is some hope here. So we close our book with some reasons to be pessimistic about individualism and some reasons to be optimistic. And so in terms of pessimism, certainly the political climate doesn't seem to be very helpful to individualism. It seems to us that individual liberty has become a bit of an abstraction, especially to young people. They don't really see how it is meaningful to them unless their health insurance is declared illegal because males need pregnancy coverage, or in case the mayor decides that you can't have a 16-ounce cup for your soda, but you could buy 2 8-ounce cups. I mean, there's some examples like that where individual liberty appears to be more pragmatic and more practical. But I think for a lot of, especially young people today, individual liberty has become a little bit of an abstraction. I think a further problem, and I say this as a former college president, I think a further reason to be pessimistic about individualism is sort of the coddling, if you will, of young people today. The so-called helicopter parents, who are very real. I have talked to a lot of them. And also on our college campuses, we see today the need for safe spaces, the need to avoid microaggressions or trigger words. One friend of mine on the faculty said, only thing I know to do about a microaggression is commit a macroaggression. And so he said, that's how I deal with it. But that's not very successful. So we're developing young people who are pretty sensitive and pretty well taken care of. And the idea of individualism is not really much encouraged for them. Reasons to be optimistic. We think, or Gordon and I think, that we are entering today some new frontiers that could be positive and helpful for rugged individualism. And I'll talk about that further in just a moment. Immigrants are pretty interested, we find, in rugged individualism. Immigrants, I think, more than native-born people, have come to this country in many cases because they want to start businesses and build a better life for their children. And so in many of the immigrant communities, we see people who are really engaged in and interested in the individualism that's offered here. And of course, the question will doubtless arise in our Q&A period, but what does Donald Trump mean for rugged individualism? And of course, like everything else, I can only say we're not sure. Do you remember the very first tweet? We have to not only study presidential addresses now, we have to study presidential tweets. The president's first tweet was about the forgotten men and women, he said, who have been heard and they won't be forgotten again. And his inaugural address was full of references, again, to the forgotten men and women. And so I'm on the telephone quickly with my co-author, and I said, well, is this Franklin Roosevelt's forgotten man come back, you know, to life? And we debated it, and we discussed it, and we said, you know, we think it's something different this time.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Roosevelt's forgotten man were people that he thought had been forgotten by the economy and by the economic titans. That big business was sort of running over people, and people, the common man, if you will, needed the power of the federal government to sort of check the power of big business and allow the forgotten man to have that sort of protection. We think actually Trump's forgotten men and women are a little different. They're people that have been, I think he believes, have been forgotten by their own government, or are being run over, or not being well protected and cared for by their own government. And so that's the forgotten man we think that Donald Trump is concerned about, the forgotten men and women who are not really being well cared for or well attended to by their own government. What we don't know, I would say, is what Trump's solution to that would be. Is he interested in more individualism, or is he interested in more sort of big government collectivism, but just aimed more to protect those kind of people? And there's some evidence both ways. We can talk about that in Q&A. And then finally, as I said, we see a little hope for the future, because young people are living on very different frontiers, if you will, of individualism, which is sometimes called networked individualism. I have three children in their 20s and 30s, and they all spend more time on their own, by themselves, in their own rooms, than I did in my teenage years or at their present ages. Interestingly, of course, even though they're by themselves and in their own room, they're connected to other people through the internet and apps and various tools that are at their disposal. So this life of networked individualism, at least they seem to be more interested in individualism. The second kind of hopeful aspect of the new frontier we see is on the business side, young people seem more interested in doing their own thing than in joining the big New York company and working there for 50 years and retiring. And so if you go down the street from my office to the Stanford Business School, you meet young people today are really inspired to start their own business, to join a startup company, to do something on the social side with their lives. Very different from the old business school aspirations, if you will, to move to New York and join a big company or a big investment firm. And so we see in both their social media lives and in their business lives some greater interest, if you will, in individualism. But we don't know how well that's going to translate to their political lives, because at the same time they say they want more individualism, we have these crazy polls saying that young people are interested more and more in socialism. And so there's a little disconnect, it seems to me, between their individualism lives and the kind of political systems that protect that and an interest in socialism. Again, a topic we can take up in a moment. So at the end, we say, we actually turn to the Bible, Revelation chapter 3 and verse 2, where the writer is addressing some churches that are dying. And the author says that his advice to them is to awaken and strengthen what remains. And so that's the conclusion of our book, is we need to awaken to the value of rugged individualism, and we need to find ways to strengthen it, to identify these liberty moments when our liberty is being challenged, to guard the constitutional protections, the checks and balances and so forth, not to do away with them. We especially think we need more civic education today. I mean, when young people don't know who their senator is, and they think Judge Judy's on the Supreme Court, and you know, on and on we can go. Clearly, if we're going to have a system of individualism that protects the republic, we need more civic education. But at the end of the day, will government really change? I mean, business has changed. Social groups, civic groups have changed, devolved into smaller, more nimble, networked kinds of businesses and social groups. Will government really change? It's hard to see that. It's hard to see the government devolving into something smaller and more nimble. At the end of the day, we have a modest plea, and that is, doesn't rugged individualism at least deserve a seat at the policy table? I'm in favor of a safety net. Herbert Hoover was in favor of equality of opportunity. We all have disagreements on how that's carried out. So I'm not arguing here that we shouldn't have safety nets. I'm just arguing that we should also have opportunities for rugged individuals that they would, the policy would also take them into account and not be simply federalizing everything sort of in favor, if you will, of the forgotten man. Well, needless to say, I could go on. There's nothing worse than an author talking about his own book. I remember the essay that the third grader was asked to write on the subject of Socrates, and he thought he could handle the subject in three sentences. He wrote, sentence number one, Socrates was a philosopher. He talked a lot. They poisoned him. And so I think it's always good to remember that if you're, if you're the public speaker, it's possible to go on too long. But we've saved ample opportunity now for questions or comments. And George, I think, has suggested how we might carry that out.
Yeah. So I'd like to remind our audience online and on the radio that they're listening to David Davenport, the co-author of Rugged Individualism and a research fellow at Hoover Institute, talk about the ideas in the book. One cultural thing, I mean, America kind of renews this myth over and over again about rugged individualism and the ideas. In the early 60s, John Kennedy called it the new frontier. And he mentioned we have to, you know, reinforce this rugged, the equality of opportunity element of it. Didn't have as much time to do any work on that, and then Lyndon Johnson took over. But The Hollywood, I think, must have taken up on that imagery because the movie How the West Was Won came out with all the big stars, and it was really a way of mythologizing the whole takeover. And I happen to have a really interesting experience with that because I was a 10-year-old boy, and we went down to Houston, Texas for a conference, and they showed this on a big cinema scope screen, you know, the huge, I mean, Houston, everything in Houston was huge. And there's this scene, maybe 20, 30 minutes in, where Jimmy Stewart, there's the robbers, and Jimmy Stewart takes a barrel of gunpowder and throws it into the fire, and it all explodes. So at that scene, the barrel is thrown into the fire. There's a huge explosion, and the entire screen goes blank. It turned out that lightning struck the building right at the moment that scene was. So the whole audience of about 1,000 people, that's what was a very dramatic. It took about an hour to put the movie back together again. but I thought it was very interesting that the mythos in that film and the Westerns and everything, and then the switch, of course, by the end of the 60s and early 70s, of all the movies countering all that,
right.
You know, like Little Big Man and so on and so forth. Then Hollywood switched and changed and said, no, we can't have the rugged individuals because it was a little too much.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I think that's – I think it's very true that rugged individualism is most encouraged and most hospitable with frontiers. Mm-hmm. But the West is not the only frontier. And so I think you're right. John Kennedy pointed to space as one example of a new frontier. And I just saw recently that the movie Hidden Figures about, you know, some rugged individuals who really worked hard to make all of that sort of work. And in the end, although they thought they had the new IBM, you know, that was going to take care of everything, well, they had to call for the rugged individual, get it in there and do this, you know, by hand to make sure it really played out. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, we think that social media presents some new frontiers for young people. And the new world of work, if you will, is a kind of new frontier. So I think the notion that individualism is encouraged and nurtured by new frontiers is absolutely right. But they don't all have to be the myth of the West. There are other frontiers.
I also like your idea of seat at the table. So I had another question for you about rugged individualism. Clearly, individualism is always a minority position because you're taking it. So what do you think at different parts of American history, what percentage of the American population preferred rugged individualism to being taken care of? Because as a society, and a democracy and a majority democracy, one would, you know, what does the majority want? And of course, we have to protect against the majority. But in general, what would you think, even at the height of rugged individualism, what do you think the percentage of people that engaged in it were?
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's a really good and hard question. I would say that when you survey people historically, say on the economic side, that poorer people have nevertheless been in favor of capitalism because they see the opportunity, if you will, even if it's not their present reality. They don't want to close off the opportunity that they might benefit from that kind of system. So there's plenty of evidence that people really like the freedom of opportunity, if you will, that you have in a system like the system of rugged individualism. On the other hand, what we're experiencing right now, I think, in our society is once you have given people more than a safety net, if you will, you've given people a kind of guarantee of something like healthcare, then their opinion begins to change. Obamacare was unpopular, very unpopular, until recently when it appeared that it might go away. Mm-hmm. So it's a hard debate, and I think it still is a very current debate today. But as I said, I think there's often a middle ground where you can create a safety net and you can also leave the opportunity. We argue in our book that the individual mandate, for example, in Obamacare, wasn't really necessary to make it work, as has been argued. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's been eaten up by exceptions such that it hasn't really worked as intended. So it probably wasn't really necessary, in effect, to have the individual mandate and to have, in a sense, federalized health care. So again, I think that's our plea, is can we find ways to make policy that addresses both the forgotten man and the rugged individual?
So, since you take that point of view, it's very interesting, since you studied that history of the 20th century for how this all developed. It seems to me a little bit that the communism in totalitarian states, but especially the communism in Russia, Soviet Union, was a competitor for the United States and freedom. Right. And capitalism, especially during the Depression, and that the fear of it actually was what melded this sort of welfare state capitalism that seems to be a more stable thing, which is a combination of the two ideas.
Right, right.
Because it takes care of different parts of society in different ways, basically.
No, I think, again, I think to me that is an accurate read of history, and it's constantly finding the right balance to me. Yeah. I mean, In my view, we live in sort of a pendular society. Things will swing to the left, and then people say, oh, that's gone too far, and things swing back a bit to the right. Elections are corrective mechanisms, constitutional protections, Supreme Court decisions. Even Roosevelt faced those. Some of his early New Deal initiatives were stopped by the Supreme Court as going too far and had to go back to the drawing board. So we have these correctives, as you say, that sort of keep a blended system working, in a sense.
So who would like to ask the first question?
Thank you for the talk. So I have two quick questions. So the first is, so you talk a lot about how equality of opportunity or equal opportunity is a really important part of a system where rugged individualism exists and for it to thrive. Can you talk a bit about why there's such an inequality of actual outcomes in our society? So is it a problem that rugged individualism has gone too far that creates sort of this inequality in outcomes where particularly minorities or, you know, people who are, you know, socioeconomically challenged, poor, essentially aren't able to, you know, rise in social status and in incomes. And then the second question is about what type of welfare system you would design to essentially have principles of individualism, you know, deeply, deeply integrated into that welfare system. You know, you talk a little bit about how Stanford students are really excited to, you know, join this new startup economy. But as you know, a lot of people have been left out in this economy. Right. We have labor force participation rates that are abysmal right now. You know, particularly uneducated people are finding that they're losing their jobs, they're spending more time playing video games, stuff like that. So eventually, you know, if we want these people to have a decent quality of life, there's going to have to be some sort of, you know, welfare system in place. And I agree that the current sort of disability, welfare through disability, is not working for these people. So I guess what is the type of welfare system that we could design that would adhere to these principles but also, you know, allow an increasing number of unemployed and potentially unemployable people to thrive or to be able to have a good life?
Wow. If I could answer that, then I should be president probably instead of addressing your first question. I will say that I think maybe in the inequality debate, which we're having these days, that we're missing a couple, three key points, that the debate has become a little distorted, if I may say. I remember taking a religion class at Stanford, and the professor said very memorably to me, he said, you know, heresy is not really untruth. Heresy is an overemphasis on one part of the truth. So I think there's some heresy in the present debate that kind of needs to be clarified. One heresy is difficult to clarify, and that is, to me, the really important data would not be so much the inequality of incomes, if you will, but the income mobility scale. And historically in this country, the income mobility possibilities have been very high. I mean, people could go from the bottom quartile to the top. They could drop from the top to the third. There's been a lot of fluidity. One of the problems with bringing that to the debate is those are long-term studies, income mobility studies, that are basically 10-year studies. And the last one has been a while. It showed that income mobility was still pretty good, but it was a little bit dated. So I think to really evaluate what we're talking about, it'd be good to understand more, because I could get more behind income mobility than I could get behind outcomes, you know, making the same kind of income or salary. A second part of the debate that I think is sometimes disordered or lost is, as Piketty and others have said in their books, but it's a big book to read, the problem is not even really at the 1% level. It's the upper 1% of the 1% that has really distorted, if you will, income inequality. It's the entrepreneurs, obviously, the Bill Gates, the Steve Jobs. It's the Hollywood stars. It's the music rock stars. It's the baseball and basketball stars. These are the incomes that have really distorted the income inequality charts. And of course, I mean, addressing that is problematic. I mean, I doubt that we want Steve Jobs to be taxed so highly that he felt like he had to start Apple in some other country or something. So again, that's a part of the debate that I think we don't have enough information about. So even I'd first love to see the income inequality debate a little sharper and a little clearer and focus on the things that we can really do. Now, your second question is, of course, even harder. If I were the czar of welfare, what would I do? And I'm not an expert on welfare. This is more a book of political philosophy, if you will, than welfare policy, certainly. I would say that in general, and I think this addresses both the people who have been in poverty for a long time, and it addresses the newer members of this frustrated economic class that came out and voted, you know, surprised everybody and voted for Trump in the Rust Belt and the upper Midwest and so forth. And that is, education is really, I think, a key issue. And by that, I don't just mean the quality of K-12 public education, although that is part of it. And even though I tend to be more conservative, I'm not in favor of the testing and the accountability and all of those kind of changes we've made to our education system. But we also, I think, don't have the right incentives for retraining people. People in these Rust Belt places, they'd be happy to work in a startup, but they're going to need some retraining. And we actually, at the moment, have a tax system that disincentivizes a lot of retraining. So I think education and the tax code and investment in education, to me, that's a more promising approach than some others that we've tried. But it's a tough question. I don't claim to have all the answers to that, certainly. Yes, sir.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk. I'm actually from South Korea, and then I always have this question that is rugged individualism. You said it's like American ideology. And does it work in other countries? Because like I used to train with U.S. Marines, and then you know, they're very patriotic and Republican, and they keep saying to me, yeah, you know, it's working because, you know, you look at all this Hollywood. But I feel like when I look at Asia, for example, Japan still has king and queen,
right?
And Korea is becoming more, South Korea is becoming more socialism country because of the election that we had 2 weeks ago, and I believe that it's not quite working in another country. And what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I would say as someone once said about something else, it's not so much that it's been tried and failed, it's that it hasn't really been tried a lot in other countries. And as you say, one requisite is sufficient freedom, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, for people to have individual liberties and rugged individualism. It's to have enough of a free market system where if you felt like you started a business or you worked hard so that your son or daughter could have a different kind of economic life and career, that there could be some payoff from that. And then, as Tocqueville and others argued, to also have the land available, at least in the incubation period. One of the things that I think is an interesting question to study is, for a while we were trying to promote democracies in other countries, and it sort of became a question of, well, how could you like build a greenhouse that would let democracy sprout and grow faster? Well, it's pretty hard to do. I mean, if you go into a country that's landlocked and that has a very powerful political and economic system, there's not a lot there to water and to nurture and to grow. So I'm not aware of other countries that have had the success with this that we have. And of course, the warning we're trying to give is kind of the Herbert Hoover warning of, you know, how much of that system do we want to undo in the name of solving some other problems? And can we keep enough of that system at the table so that it can be nurtured and live as well as take care of other social needs that we have?
Is Australia's experience closer to ours, or that was a lot of land?
Yeah, I mean, certainly you have, all I know are the myths about Australia, and certainly you have the myths of people living more that kind of life. But I, from a government point of view, I don't know enough to really give a good answer to that question, I'm afraid. Yeah, I don't know enough about Australia to give an intelligent answer. Yes.
Can I just quickly follow up? So I guess what I was trying to ask with my first question about inequality of outcomes was more along the lines of what you were talking about, which is the ability to essentially mobility, right?
Right.
And so what I'm wondering is the reason why, and this might just be a perception that I have, but I don't believe it's just a perception, that mobility is extremely low among particularly like African American poor communities. Is this because of an excess of rugged individualism where essentially a certain group has co-opted government power to set up a system where they're able to thrive? Or is the story more of some sort of like inefficient, you know, government explanation? Like what I'm wondering is like, is there too much rugged individualism sometimes, and can it, you know, create a system where, you know, once the powerful have a lot of money, they can afford, you know, the lobbyists, X, Y, and Z, and power becomes concentrated, you know.
Yep.
Is there a need for every once in a while for the rugged individualist to all kind of be cut down to size so that everyone can, you know, so that everyone can have that opportunity again?
Yeah, I think I would say the answer is yes, that in any kind of mixed system, if you will, or hybrid system, you can have heresy. You can have one side or another of an equation become too powerful. I personally doubt that that's the explanation for our inability to address problems of poverty and inequality. As I said, if it is correct that the problem is at this very top, sort of super wealthy, that's not really stopping us from doing things in other places. It's not draining, you know, Apple's not draining money from the inner city as a general rule. Mm. The kind of people who can afford to go to the Warriors game tonight are probably not, and pay Steph Curry's salary, are probably not draining money out of the inner city. I think it's probably more that we haven't come up with good solutions to problems of poverty. Mm. And I would acknowledge, I mean, I think when Herbert Hoover said, in effect, rugged individualism works in America because we also have equality of opportunity. I would say equality of opportunity is tougher to get now than it was in Herbert Hoover's day. And so if, you know, if I wanted to boost rugged individualism, I think I would also have to work on equality of opportunity for that hybrid to work.
Cool. Thank you.
I think I'm responsible for that. Yes.
David, either from personal experience or the book, can you address whether you've seen any correlation or even anti-correlation between maybe the strength of organized religion in the U.S. and rugged individualism? Because on the one hand, it would seem like religion encourages more interdependence and community, maybe antithetical to rugged individualism, but a cursory look at history might seem that when organized religion, in particular Christianity, was strongest in the U.S., that's when rugged individualism thrived. So any correlation at all or thoughts there?
Well, certainly we argue in the book that one of the roots, if you will, or part of the DNA of rugged individualism that was planted in this country was religion, specifically Christianity, and in that time, specifically a certain form of Protestant Christianity. This was part of the DNA that was planted in this country. So a key part, as we point out in the book, of that is man's individual accountability to God. Sure, you can elect or consent to join a church. We're not going to have state churches here that everybody has to join or everybody has to follow. But in America, you had freedom of religion. You could join a church by your own consent or not. If you join by your own consent, you accept some community kind of activity, presumably. But again, that's your own choice, your own decision. But ultimately, a religion in America has been more about man and woman's individual accountability to God. And so we think that is a strengthening, if you will, of individualism, and has generally been a good thing. And maybe one of our challenges today. So.
Hi. I actually have like 18 questions to ask you, but I'll limit.
Is our time about up, George?
I used to be spoiled as a student of Dr. Davenport at Pepperdine, so I could ask questions for an hour. And so I guess kind of what would be a fun question to ask is, how do you see the psychological elements of rugged individualism assisting in the turmoil that we're experiencing in Washington right now, where we have kind of that individualistic president who's not really being accountable to the other checks and balances that we've created, a mob or our populace, our population, who's not necessarily in favor of a lot of the policies. I mean, it may be a good time to tap into that ideal. If it's able to blend with a lot of the progressive ideals around Obamacare, I think the example you gave was very good in that, did we need to have it as a mandated policy? And probably, I would imagine, otherwise they may have left that out. But at the same time, it should probably be illegal for insurance companies to deny pregnancy care to women. You know, there is another half to the whole. So individualism, could it still exist and be helpful today?
Right, right. Yeah, Dr. Lloyd and I are already at work on our third book, and the working title of that book is "How Did Public Policy Become War and Not Deliberation?" And that's how we describe what's going on in Washington. It's become about winning, and it's become about war. And our current president, I think, is encouraging that further. I would also say Congress has not been helpful. It takes a powder whenever there are some big things to be done. I remember I was working in D.C. a couple of years ago when it looked like they were finally going to have a debate in Congress about what we should do in Syria. And I thought, okay, finally we're going to, you know, as a country, we're going to come in together and deliberate about this. And what did Congress do? They declared an early holiday to go home and campaign, so that they wouldn't have to take any hard votes before the election. And one of the congressmen said, in effect, to the president, he said, just bomb the place and tell us about it later. You know, this is our system of checks and balances now. So I agree with you. I think the checks and balances system has been broken for a long time. And I think to restore any sense of deliberation about our government, then we need to be strengthening that. And I'd love to see Congress, even a Republican Congress, stand up and say no to the president if he has bad ideas, and then sit down and work out some better ideas. I mean, one thing you can say in favor of the current president is he does seem willing to negotiate sometimes and try to find a deal, if you will. So maybe they can take advantage of that. But good question, and I think big problem.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Just as a follow-up to this, The Economist had actually good explanation. They actually say that we have Henry VIII.
Ah.
And then we have boardroom capitalism. So the boardroom capitalism and Henry VIII is running the country.
Yep. It's we have a unique and difficult set of circumstances right now. And believe me, Gordon and I feel like I'm Donald Trump right now. Believe me when I tell you, Gordon and I will have the solution to this in our next book, but not this one. So give us a couple years and I'll come back. Thank you very much.